support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Little Rock, Arkansas.
My name is Robin White. I'm the superintendent here at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site here in Little Rock, Arkansas. When we talk about restorative justice and how that can be double standard, whereas you are making amends with one group, that victim, but when the perpetrator comes out, they are still punished because they're denied job opportunity, they're denied housing, they're denied the right to vote, they're denied the right to be a man or a woman because all of their dignity has been stripped from them. And how do we answer that? How do we support our system fully and dismantle what we are faced with today? Because African Americans, the black and brown, we cannot do this. We cannot dismantle a system. We did not create this system. And now we are told if we are to have discussion of race and entitlement and arrogance and privilege, that it is going to be against the law. We cannot talk about our reality. So how can we share with others for them to understand what is really going on? How can we help others to grow in that pod? How can we expose them to the opportunities of who we really are and what we are made of? We are born from wounded wounds. We are born into generational trauma. Sometimes we don't understand the pain that we are suffering that has lingered on from our ancestors. And if we can't wrap our heads around it, how can we hope for others to understand until we have that dialogue?
Courtney Bradford, I'm the curator of collections at Mosaic Templars Cultural Center in Little Rock. And what Ms. White is speaking on is entitled Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. Like I said, it's ingrained in us generationally. You can find this in our DNA, the trauma and the effects, and then the things that we do now. And sometimes unbeknownst to us, we do certain things, and it's because of that trauma. It's ingrained in us. And so if my mother did it, and if her mother did it, and if her mother did it, it's in me, even when you try to get away from it. But if you do not know it, if you're not aware that it is inside of you, or it's in your DNA, or it's in your ancestral line, it is hard to bring that forth if you're in denial, or if you're just unknowledgeable of those things. We actually do talk about in my introduction to African American Studies class.
That would be a natural topic.
Yes. Yeah. It is a big topic. And what I have found that, you know, so many of my students did not know, but it opened their eyes and their mind to start looking at things and viewing not only their lives and their families and things that are portrayed in the media, things of that nature, and to kind of see the bigger aspect of that.
Give us some teaching contextual points for the kids that you would bring up.
So I teach college students. It's very amazing because it's almost as if I'm trying to reteach them. They're having to relearn their history because it has been taught one way. And so one of the biggest topics I asked them about is like, what is the dangers of whitewashing history? Like, what happens when you do that? And so they often say, you learn one way, and it's not necessarily the truth. And so we bring up Rosa Parks. You know, oftentimes she's thought of just a tired lady who was older, and she was tired that day and didn't want to get out of her seat. And in all actuality, she was an activist, and she did so many things.
Right, and she was picked. She was selected. Yes, yeah.
She was. She was chosen. And even in that instance, that was not the first time they did something like that. And so it's very interesting to see my students who are on the collegiate level, but I'm actually reteaching them what they should have learned to begin with.
This is Robin White again. There are several methods that we could use, and I talk about mental hygiene. Mm-hmm. How do we step into that mental hygiene when we are constantly apologizing for our existence? Mm-hmm. And that, as far as this apology, it's space occupants apology, as I call it. Mm-hmm. And We apologize for who we are, the color of our skin, the way we talk, for our hair, the way we look. We are constantly made to feel that we need permission for our existence. Mm-hmm. So how do we step beyond that and value ourselves? How do we step and teach children how beautiful they are? Mm-hmm. And even though all of us, a lot of us are beautifully broken, mm-hmm. we know that there is a threshold that we can go over that it to value ourselves. Mm-hmm. And all of it comes down to self-validation. It comes down to that. But also recognizing, especially, we are taught to be ashamed of seeking help, mental help. And I always talk about that part is that mental hygiene mm-hmm. and recognizing that something is amiss, that this is not right. I grew up actually going to prison a lot to visit relatives. All the men, I was constantly going to prison just to visit them as a little girl. And then maybe 20 years ago, I said, this is not normal. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is not normal, but it was normal for me. Mm-hmm. And then it took me to realize that this is not right. Mm-hmm. You know, and I grew up partially in the South and in the North. And so there are two rules. I also, at age 14, was a migrant worker picking grapefruit and oranges, Umatilla, Florida, at Golden Gems Camp. So I've been, you know, picking cotton and being in that, you know, you have to move out the way for these good people. And I was always wondering, if they're good people, what does that make me? Where do I fit in mm-hmm. with this? And that part is thinking and processing. And that's what I called mental hygiene. Mm-hmm. And looking at what's going on internally with you mm-hmm. and how we can move beyond that.
Mm-hmm. I really like that because it reminds me of how I'm raising my son. He's 6 years old and I'm very conscientious and very intentional on the things that I expose him to. You know, raising a black young man in America, I've been very intentional to see the light in his eyes and to see when we talk about, you know, other African Americans.
Yes. And a part of that was recognizing how society prescribed how we see mm-hmm. each other and how others see us. Mm-hmm. Society, there's a prescription with how we are viewed. Mm-hmm. And until we could work with both groups, our allies, for them to understand what is really going on beneath the surface. And we will never reach that threshold of us working together because you have to understand me. It's the same as with the police. You can't protect me if you don't value me. Mm-hmm. You can't protect me if you are afraid of mm-hmm. me.
If you don't know me, not familiar with me.
And mm-hmm. we have to see each other in totality and look at each other and see not what society prescribes us to see, but mm-hmm. what you generally see mm-hmm. in that beautiful man, that beautiful boy, that beautiful woman. My granddaughter is by Jamaican and she's very dark skinned and I was calling her beautiful Sasha. So at age 4, people would ask her name and she said beautiful Sasha. She thought that was mm-hmm. her name. But that seed I planted mm-hmm. in her. Even when others would call her names and it would hurt her, I would still reiterate that. You are beautiful, baby. And mm-hmm. that's how I come with beautifully broken. That there's a break in all of us. There are bits and pieces of us that hurt. There's a lot of pain within us. Mm-hmm. And moving through that, we have to work together. It just cannot be one-sided mm-hmm. for us to understand each other. As we move along, and we have to work together mm-hmm. to reach that platform. And so when I was started off at the National Park Service, it was some young children in the 5th grade that was calling me the N-word. And it was then that I decided I was going to stay within this agency, that I had a duty to work with those children, to plant those seeds of greatness with them and for it to see me in totality.
You have done special meetings and meetups with people from across society and culture, including police. Are you still doing that? Because that seems an important vehicle.
We have a strong partnership with the FBI, and there's a program they do called the Color of Law. The Color of Law, and we host it here over at Central High School and had a nice turnout because we invite the community. But I also have brought the FBI together with the American Indian Movement. There was a little heated discussion, but if we don't bring people together to discuss what is impacting them in a negative way, then we are missing. And this site, we have to deal with conflict, not only at this site, but in the National Park Service, you know, because we have to look at, even today, and we call that whitewash, our history is still lost, destroyed, forgotten, and we have a responsibility to write our own narratives, to share our own narratives. Although I am the National Park Service, I am still a woman. I am still an African American. I am still Creole. I am still Gullah and Geechee. And they don't dream what I dream. They don't see what I see. And so we have to share with each other to break down those culture barriers. We have to share with each other to break down those social barriers so you can see me and I can see you. I was in college and my teacher put a young man and I together to do a project. And when it was our turn, the young man, he said, "I am so angry at my parents because they taught me that black people were ignorant. They taught me all these negative things. And I worked and just in partnering with Robin, in partnering with me, is all attitude change, the attitude on who we are." And I think that we have to do that. They have to. In breaking down those social barriers, we have to come together. We have to dialogue. Until we have that dialogue and look at how we could break down those barriers, the wall will still be there. Those negative concepts will still be there. Devaluing us will still be there. And not looking at us as a human being. You know, I am not a monster. I am not a monster. My sons are not a monster. And we have a responsibility to invest in the future.
When you look at the little kids and you try to translate to you when you were kids, do you see progress?
I do see there's an absence, a gap per se. And I'm not sure if it's because there's so many people who are not sure or not knowledgeable of that history. It has not been presented. In some aspects, if it's not presented in the classroom, that's the only way they're going to get it. Like the program, a lot of students in the Delta, from my experience with working with students from the Delta, they can't afford to go to a museum or it's not important necessarily for parents to stop and say, "Hey, we're going to go to the museum and learn this lesson today." And so, but there is a lack, and it's simply because it's not taught in schools. And then if the parents don't know, they cannot teach their children. And so having public programming that families can access and they can sit down and teach the story outside of a regular classroom setting is the most important way for them to get that information.
We have to plant those seeds. Even if you think they don't hear you, they hear you.
Definitely.
In a big picture, in the here and now, you go back to Ferguson, Floyd. Are we learning anything? Are we going forward? Is there room for optimism?
I would say from my personal experience, Ferguson, when that happened, I had just found out that I was pregnant with my son, but I did not know he was a boy yet. But I remember thinking, I said, "Oh my God." I said, if he's a boy, what am I gonna do? And all these things are happening. Like, how am I gonna raise my son?
I was only told what happened. My grandparents taught in Dunbar lots of segregation, but to carry a child and not know what's gonna happen to my child. When I found out he was a boy, I said, "Oh my God." But I asked God to help me raise him in this world, in this society, because I had no idea. As a black woman, I was like, "I don't know how to raise a man. But how do I raise a man that society doesn't think he's dangerous? He's cute." I'll say, "My son is so cute. And everyone says how cute he is." But I said, "He's cute now. When does he stop being cute? When does he become dangerous?" So it's always being conscientious. Like, history repeats itself. And I tell my students, I said, "This is a movement. What's happening now is a movement. And it happened before. We know that." We look at Emmett Till. His death sparked a movement. And these are teenagers, these are college students who are going out and making this happen. It's having those conversations, I think, because I'll say maybe with the election of President Obama, people started believing that we were in a post-racial society, and we were not. We are not. It might appear to be, but the conversations still are not had. I always say that racism is the big white elephant that sits in the room that no one wants to talk about, and we dance around it, and no one wants to say anything, but it's
It's the hurt. It's the brokenness that comes with it. And that everyone's really careful. Don't break the elephant. Don't do it. But we're already broken inside. And we're not speaking about what is really going on. And so now that we have cameras and Facebook and Instagram, we can really see. And then it becomes no longer race, I'll say. Now it becomes humanity. Exactly. So my young people, keep with the movement. I'm not as young. I'm still young, but not as young. But continue to be that change. Continue to be what you want to see. And I see a change, but there's still so much work that needs to be done because this is generational. The racism, it didn't pop up overnight. It's not going to go away overnight. And so it's the continuous conversation. Keep talking about it.
What's really interesting, a couple years ago, I spent a week in Birmingham, and one of my most touching takeaways, it was the kids. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the grown-ups.
The movement is built on the backbone of our youth. From almost every movement, every cry, every warrior cry came from the mouth of our babes. We have to look at what they called riots, were really massacres. Mm-hmm. And until it's owned that this was a massacre, not a riot. Mm-hmm. And you look at the cities that these are happening, off our back we go. When our ancestors were enslaved and they had little bounty looking and searching fugitives, mm-hmm. from generation to generation, they went on to become cops. They went on to become policemen. Mm-hmm. Leaving from the South, they come up North with that mentality that we are nothing, with that mentality that we are ignorant, that with that mentality, I dare you question me. And so we have to teach our children, male and females, how to survive when they're stopped. And they still, you know, we can't take that fear out of them. I think that will come from conversations, that will come from behavior, that will come from how they are perceived, how they are seen, and how those authoritative figures, how they treat us, how they treat our children, and that interaction. And we have to look at our responsibility for that new frame of mind, but there must be willingness to participate in this also, because these lynchings, new age lynchings, has been going on forever. This is nothing new. What is new is that it's in real time. You look at slavery by another name, and how many African-American males disappeared to work in mines, to work on plantations. That's a whole nother concept. Then you look at the mass incarceration, how our imprisoned black and brown men are a commodity. They are a commodity.
What's even compounded because of for-profit.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. How are we going to tear it down? How are we going to dismantle this? Or even for someone to truly understand where we're coming from. That is a whole new conversation that we have to look at.
In the midst of the takedown, people will have to be honest. Yes. It's honest. Honesty about the history. And that's where the lines get blurred. And
when we talk about our history, the first thing we hear, well, I didn't do this. Or right. You're doing white guilt. It's not about that. It's about the humanity. What does it cost to participate in humanity? Mm-hmm. What is the cost of humanitarian acts? Why is it illegal just to show some humanity and to see each other, to have conversations? Mm-hmm. What is the fear? And I often ask myself, what is really going on? And you see so many unarmed black men just shot, killed. Is this really... I have to ask, if you are that afraid, why are you in that position?
Exactly.
If you are a coward, why are you wearing that uniform? You are not fit to serve. If every time you see a person of color, fear sets in, where does that come from? Mm-hmm. I think some of it is a myth, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think some enjoy doing it, but I also think it's what that's in their DNA. Like we are come from wounded wounds in our DNA. I also think that is in their DNA as well, to see us and fear us. They don't see a person, they see a monster. When you could shoot a child, mm-hmm. and pull weapons on children. Mm-hmm. But you are not going to do that with children of your race. You are mm-hmm. going to pacify them. You're going to talk. You're going to embrace them. You want to break mm-hmm. it down. You want to know what's wrong. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to ours, there's no value, no problem with putting a bullet in our children, mm-hmm. no problem with taking their lives, because we do not matter.
Let's say African Americans are not human, which we go back to the Three-Fifths Compromise. They weren't considered humans. It's still ingrained. It's still taught. Mm-hmm. Just like certain things are taught within our community that we can link back to post-traumatic slave syndrome. I believe everyone has a bit of that. Your ancestors might not have been the enslaved, but they were slaveholders. And if we think that that doesn't have an impact, or if that did not get passed down generationally, we're sorely mistaken to think that it's not. And so when you talk about the slave patrols, I mean, the police was formed out of these organizations that were, you know, made simply just to catch enslaved people. And we know the horrible things that were said, and the adjectives that are used to describe what we know as people, but they did not see them as that. And it's still ingrained. We see that in magazines, in the movies, in the TV shows. And I tell my students, oftentimes, some people might not have ever encountered an African-American individual in their entire lives. And their only experience with them is the TV. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the news, whether it's a television show or a music video, all of these things play a role in how we perceive each other. For some reason, it's easier for some to hate.
I could keep you guys here all day. What a touching moment.
My name is Robin White. I'm the superintendent here at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site here in Little Rock, Arkansas.
My name is Courtney Bradford. I'm the curator of collections at the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center here in Little Rock.
Thank you guys so much. What a touching afternoon.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust preservation initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So yes, please support your local NPR station.